Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 17, Text 41, Punishment and Reward of Kali. Adhaitani na seveta
Adhaitani na seveta
Bhubhushu purusha prachit
Bhubhushu purusha prachit
Visheshato dharmashilo
Visheshato dharmashilo
Adhaloka patir guru
Adhaloka patir guru
Adhatani na seveta Upuchu purusha kvachit Visheshato dharma shilo Raja loka patir guru Adhatani na seveta Upuchu purusha kvachit Visheshato dharma shilo Aloka patir guru
Thank you.
Therefore, etani, all these, never, seveta, come in contact, bhupushu,
those who desire well-being,
purusha, persons, vachit,
in any circumstances,
visheshata, specifically,
dharmashila,
those who are on the progressive path of liberation,
raja,
the king,
lokapati,
public leader,
guru,
the brahmins and the sannyasis.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada.
Therefore, whoever desires progressive well-being, especially kings, religionists, public leaders, brahmins, and sannyasis, should never come in contact with the four above-mentioned irreligious principles. Report. The brahmins are the religious preceptors for all other castes, and the sannyasis are the spiritual master for all the castes and orders of society. So also are the king and the public leaders who are responsible for the material welfare of all people. The progressive religionists and those who are responsible human beings or those who do not want to spoil their valuable human lives should refrain from all principles of irreligiosity, especially illicit connection with women. If a Brahmin is not truthful, all his claims as a Brahmin at once become null and void. If a sannyasi is illicitly connected with women, all his claims as a sannyasi at once become false. Similarly, if the king and the public leader are unnecessarily proud or habituated to drinking and smoking, certainly they become disqualified to discharge public welfare activities. Truthfulness is the basic principle for all religions. The four leaders of human society, namely the sannyasis, the brahmins, the king, and the public leader, must be tested crucially by their character and qualification. Before one can be accepted as a spiritual or material master of society, he must be tested by the above-mentioned criteria of character. Such public leaders may be less qualified in academic qualifications, but it is necessary primarily that they be free from the contamination of the four disqualifications, namely gambling, drinking, prostitution, and animal slaughter. So we're getting towards the end of this chapter, and now we're getting the very specific recommendations, sort of the takeaways from everything that has happened so far as the instructions for society. And in this nice verse today, we're talking about the role of leaders, religious leaders, spiritual leaders, and also the material leaders, administrative leaders of society, and how much character is it so important for anyone who's in those roles. But unfortunately, of course, this has to be discussed because we're talking about the advent of Kali. Kali has made his appearance here, and therefore all of these good qualities are starting to deteriorate as we see today. Now, it's interesting that this is, of course, how the Bhagavatam started. The sages at Naimisharanya had come to perform sacrifice, knowing that Kali Yuga, the Holy Yuga, was already there. Krishna had left the planet.
So it was not fully enforced, but it was beginning. And they could see what was going to be happening out in Kali Yuga. And so they talked about that. And even in the very first chapter, verse 10, they said, O learned one, in this iron age of Kali, men almost always have a short lives. They are quarrelsome, lazy, misguided, unlucky, and above all, always deserved. So that's our life today. 2020 and 2021. Almost 22. Okay. See, that's, you know, our problem with the mind. Okay. So one of those qualities that's been specifically discussed in today's purport is this idea of being misguided. How people are misguided in this particular age and in all societies. This word samanda matayo is used in the Bhagavatam. Misguided, Prabhupada translates it. And so in this particular purport, Srila Prabhupada is mentioning that there are four categories of persons who are responsible for guiding the citizens. But this is a very, very important duty, important responsibility. First of all, there are the religious and spiritual leaders. And there are two mentioned here. One is the guru, Prabhupada translates this as Brahmins and Sannyasis. And the other is that those on the progressive path of religion. So Prabhupada kind of uses this both as the individuals who are trying to pursue religious principles, religious practice, and also those who are religious leaders guiding those on the path of religion. And then the two administrative leaders responsible for the material welfare of all people. First of all, Raja, who is the king, and then Lokapati, other public leaders. So we could think of all of our, you know, non-royal administrative leaders, presidents, governors, anybody who is responsible, probably the mayor of the city, all these public leaders. They all have a very, very specific responsibility towards the spiritual and material welfare of the people. Now, in Kali Yuga, unfortunately, there's a great failure in all four types of these leaders. That is what we're talking about today. And that failure, of course, comes about because of the lack of character and qualities, particularly in terms of strictly following principles of religion. So, Prabhupada mentioned that first, he said 95% of people are not following religious principles. About 5% of people are following religious principles. But then he also said the same, like the next sentence, 95% of people are innocent. Or sometimes Prabhupada said ignorant. Ignorant or innocent. In other words, they don't know. And only really 5% are not so innocent. But those 5% are the leaders who are misleading people. The Prabhupada made it very clear. This is what we have exactly as being told in Bhagavatam 5,000 years ago, that we have a small percentage of very irreligious leaders who misguide the people. So we have both public leaders and religious leaders who tend to misguide the rest of the people under their charge. And this is a real problem. So it's also been discussed here that the failure of that leadership is primarily due to breaking the regular principles. Because there's no quality of religion. Of course, we've been reading this in the last several verses, that the breaking of religious of these principles has a direct connection with the breakdown of the principles of religion. So thus, we don't have mercy, truthfulness,
cleanliness.
Yeah. So those aren't present because of the breaking of the corresponding break with your principles. And so these four mention, but also Prabhupada mentions in his purport two other principles that are very closely associated with the four religious principles and the four irreligious principles, which are pridelessness and truthfulness. So pride as a difficulty, particularly in administrative leaders, is mentioned here, and truthfulness as a problem with religious leaders. So I thought those were interesting points, how Prabhupada connects those principles also with the regular principles, you know, and how those are broken down as part of the breakdown of the principles of religion. Therefore, the leaders do not have these values, they don't know the truth, and they're themselves misled and misleading others. And Prabhupada also says here that how important his truthfulness is. He says the basic principle of religion is truthfulness.
This is 12.3.33. It says there are different countries in different parts of the world, and each and every country may have different types of sacrifice to please the Supreme Lord. But the central point in pleasing him is ascertained as truthfulness. The basic principle of religion is truthfulness. The ultimate goal of all religion is to satisfy the Lord. So, truthfulness. This has directly with being misguided. One doesn't know the truth, how can guide another person towards the truth? And the inability to follow the principles of religion immediately leads to this misguidance. Now, they're actually incapable of truthfulness. I mean, it's not, first of all, there's material motivation, behind politics, behind administration, so many things. It's very difficult to find someone who purely just wants to serve in the material world. Some people have some desire, obviously, to do for public service or for the common welfare and like that. But often you see, as people get into politics and into leadership, it's almost like they start out maybe with some good motives and they kind of get corrupted along the way. And pretty soon it becomes a matter of holding your position, keeping power. It's like, if you ever read the news, anything about politics, it's like, you just don't even want to read it after a while. It's like, everyone's talking about jockeying for what's going to happen in 2022 and 2024, and how are we going to position ourselves, both parties, all parties, how are we going to position ourselves, to be able to keep our power or gain power? And that's what it seems to be all about. What to speak if there's any other material benefits that might come along the way, and those things, of course, are there. And secondly, most people could not guide their citizens properly because they don't know the truth. They have no real spiritual knowledge. So what do they have to impart? So they are in turn misguided. They misguide the followers and all the common people who might be innocent. People tend to accept authority, right? I remember even as most of us grew up, unless you happen to be fortunate, you grew up in a Vaishnava family or something like that. But for most of us, we accepted the authorities. We accepted what the scientists told us, what the teachers told us in school, what our parents told us. This is natural. So, in a sense, we were innocent. Those of us who grew up, your parents never were saying, basically, if you don't eat meat, you're going to die, lack of protein. And some of you are getting quite old, surprised you've made it this long, being vegetarian. Now it's so strange, because now it's like, it seems like almost everybody thinks vegetarianism is healthy. It's like they might say, well, I don't want to do it, almost everybody admits it's healthy. Where it used to be, we were told, this is like terrible. You shouldn't do this. It's 50, 60 years ago. This is a prevailing story. So anyway, people tend to accept authority, whether it's right or wrong. And that's so therefore, it so much behooves the leaders to know the truth. In that purport to 1.110, Prabhupada said, in this age, many unscrupulous men manufacture their own religious faith, which is not based on any revealed scriptures, and very often people who are addicted to sense gratification are attracted by such institutions. Consequently, in the name of religion, so many sinful acts have been carried on that the people in general have neither peace of mind nor health of body. So, this is going specifically to the downfall of religious leaders and the lack of leadership and the misguidance that comes from so-called religionist spiritual leaders, gurus, whatever they may be. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the things that happen in Western religions, but we're going to be equal opportunity here. And both Western and Eastern religions, I think, have their fair share of cheating or lack of knowledge that comes here. So you see, in almost all religions, you see both. You see some thread of genuine spirituality, where there's a desire to try to know God, serve God, love God, in many religions. But then you also see, because of Kali Yuga, the material contamination that creeps in, and they often become corrupted or cheating like that. So this isn't to say all religions are cheating. This is to say, unfortunately, that often comes into the picture, just due to the age we're in. And even if it's not outright cheating, materialism very easily comes into religion. And people who seek material rewards, you know, will often look to God or look to religiosity to fulfill those material desires. And also, those religions which propound that you will get some material benefit, they will attract followers. So, you know, it's a very strong connection there. We see, like today, this increasing popularity of what's called prosperity religions, Christianity. It's been around for a long time, but it's just in the last decade or so become really popular. These are often these big mega churches, you know, with thousands and thousands of members. And they're generally lumped in what's called prosperity gospel or prosperity theology. And the basic tenet is that God wants you to be wealthy. God wants you to have all material success. And if you are wealthy, that's a sign that God has, you know, indeed favored you. Now, a little bit of truth to that. Of course, you've done something pious to get that, to have the karma, to be wealthy, perhaps. But that doesn't mean in this lifetime. That's what they don't understand. That could be from pious activity in your last lifetime. This lifetime, you may be completely impious, but be wealthy. So they also say that it's a contract you have with God. God, if you're serving God and you're praying to God, he must answer your prayers and he must give you wealth. You know, he's your order supplier. You know, you put in your order, ka-ching, and you know, you, the dollars are supposed to come, I guess. Just as an example of the, and these people have a great impact. Some of your televangelists, you know, millions of followers, and they're very wealthy. Good example, this may not, no, I'm going to go ahead and say it. Paula White is one of these televangelists who's very, very popular, and she was Donald Trump's spiritual advisor. She gave the inauguration, gave the prayers and like that. Anyway, in 2007-11, the Senate Finance Committee did a big investigation of several of these churches, and it turned out that, according to the report, that her foundation received $150 billion in donations over 2 years, and the church spent tax-exempt ministry funds in 1 year to pay $900,000 for her and her husband's waterfront mansion, paid salaries to the family members, and also paid for their private jet. So, I mean, this is just one example. I mean, you can follow, you know, there's so many of these things. But this is a so-called spiritual leader that's advising millions, including the President of the United States. So they have impact, they have influence, and they're cheating, and they're misleading people. Now, if we turn to the East, we have no lack of cheating coming out of India either. Of course, first of all, many of the teachings emphasize material reward. We know that. Worship of the demigods. And many are bewildered by these teachings because these are actually innovators. Now, they've been misinterpreted a lot sometimes. They're not followed real carefully. Probably people don't really do all the sacrifices that are really, if you really got into them. But still, we see that the Vedas have kind of like something for everyone. You know, we even know the Puranas. There's six Puranas in the mode of goodness, six for the mode of passion, six for the mode of goodness. Of course, we have the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the Amala Purana, which is completely pure. You know, so that's all there. But Bhagavad Gita says very clearly in the seventh chapter, 7:20, 23, those whose intelligence has been stolen by material desires surrender unto demigods and follow the particular rules and regulations of worship according to their own natures. Men of small intelligence worship the demigods. Their fruits are limited and temporary. But those who worship demigods go to the planets of the demigods, but my devotees ultimately reach my supreme planet. So, Krishna is telling us very clearly in Bhagavad Gita, although those things may be there, and there may be even certain paths that are given, it's not the most intelligent thing to do. An intelligent person doesn't worship the demigods, even though our rules and regulations there for that practice, but worships, he says, me, Krishna, and we'll come to him, and we'll get out of this material world. And of course, we know that in the Vedas, there also is called the path of property and liberty. And the path, Prabhupada explains in 7:15:47 purport, according to the Vedas, there are two kinds of activities, property and liberty. Prabhriti activities involve raising oneself from a lower to a higher condition of materialistic life, whereas nivritti means the cessation of material desires. Through prabhriti activities, one suffers from material entanglement. But by nivritti activities, one is purified and becomes fit to enjoy eternal, blissful life. So
So, of course, that's all discussed in the story of the Daksha and the Haryashvas, and Narada Muni preaches to them about Prabhupada Marg and Nivruti Marg, which Daksha was the big proponent of Prabhupada. You know, he's saying that, well, you have to just kind of burn up all your material desires. You have to fulfill them first. And Marg is saying, no, you don't. You can transcend them. You can become transcendental to the material world, material desires, material body, and simply go on to the spiritual plane. Now, although these may be lower teachings in a sense, at least they have some scriptural basis. But we've also seen in modern society there's a proliferation of interest in things coming from India and East which have no scriptural basis, really, or really aren't applied correctly. Like today we see this proliferation of interest in yoga, meditation, but very few people really know what this is for and what it means. And some of these practices are simply cheating, and some are just, you know, so watered down they're almost unrecognizable as coming from any Vedic literature. In 1972, Srila Prabhupada said in class, this mystic exercise, that's what he called yoga, this mystic exercise, no need. In Kali Yuga, it is not possible. The yoga practice in your Western countries is very popular, but that is a farce. Yoga practice is very difficult, especially in this age. So most of these practices are really not kind of bona fide. Yoga, of course, is extremely popular now, but it's mostly an exercise class. You know, I used to go to an exercise class for seniors at the YMCA before COVID, and then, the person doing the exercise class, you know, this kind of a normal person, you know, who's physically fit, you know, and then at the end, they did the yoga class. Okay, those are staying for yoga class. You know, it's like they had qualifications to teach yoga, I guess. So, and of course, Prabhupada also specifically mentioned the mystic yoga system, or what's called the Ashtanga Yoga, an Eightfold Path. And Patanjali was a proponent, and there are scriptures that give that path, and it's completely bona fide. And it actually leads you to liberation. But nobody can do it. It's not meant for this age. It's impossible for anyone to read Prabhupada to follow the Patanjali system, the Eightfold Ashtanga Yoga path to perfection. So therefore, I mean, people do teach this. Their class is billed as Ashtanga Yoga. But it's cheating, because it's not Ashtanga Yoga. The fact is that most people want an easy path. They don't want too many restrictions. They want to just kind of show up for the yoga class, you know, kind of like, you know, they do for whatever, you know. And it's just, you know, something in their schedule that they think is healthy. And there's nothing wrong with it. It certainly is healthy. But it's not real spiritual life. Now, back in the 60s, those of you around remember, we saw an invasion of gurus and swamis from India. It wasn't just Srila Prabhupada. Around the same time, a lot of different ones came. And we had a self-proclaimed incarnation who performed miracles, and ashes came out of his hands or something. We had a 14-year-old boy wonder. I don't know what happened to him. And then one real popular Indian guru, I think he was from India, but he's situated in Oregon. He finally got totally discredited. He was very popular, but turned out he was having sex with all his women disciples. So he lost popularity real quickly. And I mean, we had another one that was very popular, of course, was the meditation movement, which I think is still around. And everyone got a personal mantra. Well, turns out they were all the same. You know, usually they just used a few of the simple bead mantras that we use indeed, and so they had two or three words they give everybody, and they told almost all personal mantra. And you don't really have to do much else, I guess, except meditate on that. Fortunately, we had one bona fide guru who taught the absolute truth. Srila Prabhupada also came along with them or before them and gave us the real thing. Gave us Krishna consciousness, gave us real spiritual life, absolute truth. And he didn't make it easy. Made us follow the principles, made us get up early, made us, you know, actually perform sadhana bhakti. You know. But so many people came and did it because there was some real benefit. It was tangible. And one could just by reading his books, you know, one could see that this was the truth. At least a lot of people did. So we saw this difference between the results of cheating religion and real religion. And the real guru, the real sannyasi, the real Brahman, who comes and gives that truth compared to so many that came and went and really didn't have a lot of effect on people's lives. So Prabhupada connects, discusses this other type of cheating, excuse me, or untruthfulness. He says, if a sannyasi illicitly is connected with women, all his claims as a sannyasi at once become false. And the verse from 12.3.32 in the Bhagavatam says, so-called priests and intellectuals in Kali Yuga will be devotees of their bellies and genitals. So Srimad Bhagavatam kind of tells it like it is. You know, that, and unfortunately, this is the situation that, you know, that's so commonly there, like this one guru that had this big fall down. A really good story that exemplifies this. I always kind of like this one. I'll go ahead and read it. I think I've got tonight time. The story of Bhaktisiddhanta and his Guru Maharaj, Gaurakishore Das Babaji, when Gaurakishore Das Babaji disappeared from this world. So I'm just going to read this. I think this is from Rupa Vilas's book about Bhaktisiddhanta. After departure, thank you. After after the departure of Babaji Maharaj, there are many types of opinions and disturbances over who would give his samadhi. Hiralala Goswami and a few other people sent Padmanabha Brahmachari, also known as Krishna Chaitanya Das, to Sridhar Mayapur to fetch Srila Prabhupada, Sri Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. They also told me to go with him. So this has been told by one of his disciples who was with him at the time. Crossing over the river by the Kulia ferry boat, I saw Prabhupada coming with bare feet and covered with a green chadar. With him was Paramananda Brahmachari. It was then the period of Chaturmasya and Prabhupada's hair and beard were long. Seeing him, I crossed in respect, told him the whole situation. Okay. Various heads of the Navadvipa Vaishnav gathering places, they began to argue amongst themselves over taking Srila Babaji Maharaj's spiritually blissful body. And they began to rise in order to give the samadhi. The reason being that in the future, the samadhi of such a perfect great person could be used as an instrument to raise monetary income. Srila Prabhupada resisted such illegitimate attempts of theirs. In apprehension of a breach of peace, Navadvipa's inspector police was then present at that place. The Detective Department Commissioner Roy Bahadur Yatidranath Sina Mahashaya was then Navadvipa's inspector police. After much controversy, the Babaji said, Saraswati Thakur is not a sannyasi. Therefore, he does not have the eligibility to give the samadhi for a person who has renounced his home. And of course, he's a Brahmacha. In reply to that, Prabhupada said in a loud voice like thunder, I am the only disciple of Paramahamsa Babaji Maharaj. Even though I have not accepted sannyas, I am a celibate Brahmachari. And by the grace of Babaji Maharaj, I am not secretly addicted to abominable habits or involved in fornication as some monkey-like people are. If there is someone amongst the people present who is a renunciate of truly stainless character, then he can give Babaji Maharaj's samadhi. We have no objection to that. He who within the last 1 year, or the last 6 months, 3 months, 1 month, or at least within 3 days has not had any illicit contact with a woman will be able to touch this spiritually blissful body. If anyone else touches it, he will be completely ruined. Hearing these words, the inspector of police said, how will evidence be had for this? Prabhupada said, I will have faith in their word. We become amazed at seeing them all, after Prabhupada's words, the people present wearing the attire of Babaji's, one by one, turned their backs and went away. Inspectors of police were speechless. And according to Srila Prabhupada's instructions, we had the good fortune to carry the spiritually blissful body of Paramahamsa Babaji Maharaj. So there we have the example of all these Babaji's who are supposedly in the renounced order of life, and they're criticizing, saying that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati isn't qualified because he's not a sannyasi. But he was a total Naishika Brahmachari, right, celibate his entire life, and then none of them could even admit to being celibate for 3 days. So, you know, the cheating goes on. Truthfulness is a very important principle. Bhagavatam 8:24 says, there's nothing more sinful than untruthfulness. Because of this, Mother Earth once said, I can bear any heavy thing except a person who is a liar. And of course, we know truthfulness is the last leg of religion standing, but it's wobbling, it's shaky. You know? Almost, it will go more and more as Kali Yuga goes on. So truthfulness, of course, is mentioned throughout the Bhagavad Gita as qualities created by Krishna, divine qualities, qualities by which the Brahmins work. So it's stated several times how important this is. So the qualities of Brahmins are very important. And Prabhupada mentions this as important religious leaders. And it starts with truthfulness. First, we've probably all heard the story of Gautama Muni. A boy comes to be his disciple. Gautama Muni only accepts sons of Brahmins. He asks the boy who his father was. The boy doesn't know who his father was. He says, go tell, ask your mother. He asks his mother, and his mother said, I've been with many men. I don't really know who your father is. The boy returns to Gautama and he tells him this. And Gautama Muni says, you are actually a Brahmin, and you are truly honest. Then he accepted him as a disciple. Because that was the mark. That's the mark. Not your birth necessarily, or who your mother, who your father was. But if you have these qualities, if you have this quality of truthfulness, then you're Brahmin. This is the story here. So what is truthfulness? Truthfulness is more than just, you know, the story of George Washington. He sat down a cherry tree and then he said, I cannot tell a lie, I did it. Okay, nobody said, well, why did he cut down the cherry tree? But anyway, after he did that, apparently that was his big claim to fame, being truthful. As though that's very unusual, which it is, I guess, in Kali Yuga. But does being truthful about something that you, some childish mistake you made, does that make you a leader? No. Truthfulness means knowing the absolute truth, knowing the real purpose of life. And this is the problem. So Srila Prabhupada often stated that real knowledge is knowing Krishna, the absolute truth. This is all the way through the very first verse of Bhagavatam, Satyam Param Dhimahi, I meditate on the absolute truth. Prabhupada translated, Satyam Param is absolute truth. And then he proceeds to state that Krishna is an absolute truth. So that's truthfulness, knowing the absolute truth. Real quickly, another quality that the Prabhupada talks about here is pride. and it says that often arises from material activity. Prabhupada says, similarly, if the king and the public leader are necessarily proud or habituated to drinking and smoking, they become disqualified to discharge public welfare activities. So with any material or spiritual success, everyone has that danger of pride. That's just kind of a natural part of our psychology. That we experience how easy it is, probably all of us, that we do one little thing, we do something, you know, it's very easy to become proud. It's the smallest thing. Prabhupada said, what was the saying he said? Even a pauper is proud of his penny or something. You know, it's like, he's got something, you know, so he's proud of, you know. Millionaire is proud of what he has, the pauper is proud of what he has. So why do we become pride? Why do we become proud? You know, for what? Of course, it's false ego, because we think we're the doer. We think that we are not giving, and we are responsible, and we're not giving credit to the person who's really responsible, of course, in Krishna. So, we have to also be very careful as devotees not to develop pride. Because, you know, there can be spiritual pride. I mean, some spiritual pride, well, that's kind of an advanced concept, and spiritual pride is good, I guess. But, you know, I mean, it's okay, I think, to be a little bit proud, like say, I'm really proud of my spiritual masters and like that. I mean, that's not bad, you know, but for the most part, we want to be very, very careful not to be puffed up, not to become falsely proud of any quality we have or anything that we've accomplished. Because Prabhupada always said, you have to act as though you're the doer, but know that you're not. In other words, you know, it's not that you do nothing. Well, Krishna does everything. No. You know, you have to. Doing is service. Our role is to be servant of Krishna, so we serve. But we know that we are not the doer. Krishna is responsible for everything. Krishna says, I'm the ability in man. That's why all things just depend on me. You know, that's what the devotee has to do. Knowing that he has to turn to Krishna for everything. And in one lecture, Prabhupada quotes that biblical injunction, pride comes before a fall. So, again, we have to be very careful. Because even in advanced state, one can fall down due to pride. The Nectar Devotion, Chapter 7, says, sometimes even at risk, a sannyasi in the line of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu may accept even a person who is not thoroughly fit to become a disciple, which Prabhupada did several hundred times. However, if one increases the number of disciples simply for some prestige or false honor, it will surely fall down in the matter of executing Krishna consciousness. So even in an advanced state, even in the state of being a guru, one can fall down if he becomes proud. But fortunately for the sincere devotees, Krishna protects us even from pride, us. He protects his sincere devotees. When Lord Brahma sees Krishna and is instructed by Krishna at the beginning of creation, he becomes concerned he'll become proud. He says, O my Lord, the unborn, you have shaken hands with me just as a friend does with a friend. I shall be engaged in creation of different types of living beings, and I shall be occupied in your service. I shall have no perturbation, but I pray that all this may not give rise to pride as if I were the supreme. Well, Lord Brahma is concerned about becoming proud, and he's probably one of the few people who would have good reason to be proud. He's only created the entire universe, all the living entities and everything here. But he's a pure devotee. So he says, I want to not become proud, and I'll always remember you. And then Krishna speaks to the Chatur Shlokas. He gives him complete knowledge. And then says, O Brahma, just follow this conclusion by fixed concentration of mind, and no pride will disturb you, neither in the partial nor in the final devastation. So the advanced devotee is not concerned so much, with pride, because he knows that everything is coming from Krishna, and he prays to Krishna to help him to not become proud. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the qualities of knowledge, the first one listed is humility. And Prabhupada describes that. He says, humility means that one should not be anxious to have the satisfaction being honored by others. The material conception of life makes us very eager to receive honor from others, but from the point of view of a man in perfect knowledge, who knows that he's not his body, anything, honor or dishonor, pertaining to his body is useless. So, some very important lessons in this verse and purport today. To be very careful about pride, truthfulness, four regular principles, and understand that true leaders, both spiritual and material, must have the qualities and practice of a truly religious person to be able to properly guide those on. Okay? Any questions or comments? No? Just go to the back. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for a very nice class, Prabhu. Very interesting things to meditate on. You know, it made me wonder about the principle of truthfulness in the context of spiritual life, and that sometimes we have this experience, certainly with leaders sometimes, that people will perhaps tell white lies to protect people's feelings or to protect the greater good or whatever it is. And then, of course, we also see in the spiritual world that there's all kinds of trickery and things like this going on. So I'm curious your thoughts about that.
You mean material or spiritual trickery?
Well,
not like just in the gopis or something.
Yeah, in the spiritual world that everything is crooked, right? That there's always kinds of cheating and trickery, and so it seems like almost in a way that sometimes people use that principle as an excuse to be less than truthful here. And
there are times when you maybe wouldn't be truthful. One would be for the greater benefit of the person. I'm trying to think of an extreme example. You know, like, okay, you're in Nazi Germany, and there's a family of Jewish people downstairs, and the SS come in, they say, is anybody here? And you might say, nope, nobody's here. Now, that would be telling a lie, but, you know, obviously to save somebody's life, you know. In other words, there are gradations of values, but I think you're not talking about that extreme. There's a principle, I was just looking at that, a verse that's talking about truthfulness is something about telling the truth in a palatable way or in a kind way. In other words, you want to speak honest words, but palatably. So in other words, you don't have to be brutally honest with somebody. You know, you like the new sari, but that's the ugliest thing I ever saw. You're being truthful, maybe. You don't need to say that. You know what I mean? In other words, there's limits to truthfulness. If it's used to hurt somebody, if it's painful to somebody, you know, in other words, you know, use your common sense, obviously, something like that. But generally speaking, when we talk about truthfulness, we're really talking about understanding spiritual life, spiritual experience, spiritual knowledge. And speaking spiritual knowledge honestly to people is what truthfulness is. And Srila Prabhupada, it's like sometimes he was really, really just so straightforward and strong with people, you'd almost go, wow, he said that to them? Just telling it like it was, you know. Sometimes he was more diplomatic because he could sense what the person needed. Whether they needed really just to be kind of shaken out of their ignorance or their, especially if somebody got into impersonalism or speaking some Mayavadi stuff, Prabhupada would really come down hard. But if a person was, you know, just a little bit material attached, you know, probably really nice to them and, you know, ask about their children and their grandchildren, you know, just, you know, and just, you know, kind of win them over with kindness and then preach to them. So we have to be expert, I think, like Prabhupada. Prabhupada was expert in how to dispense truth in a palatable way.
That reminds me of something that I've heard that Prabhupada said, that actually I'm the biggest cheater. Because if you had any idea what it would take to become perfect in spiritual life, then
yeah,
you wouldn't have come. He said this privately to somebody, but I thought that was quite amazing, you know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I was thinking of the famous lie that Yudhisthira spoke in the battle of Kurukshetra, because Krishna directed him to say...
Oh, yeah. You know, about Bhishma and that?
Pardon?
You know, Yudhishthira?
Ashwatthama, the elephant.
Oh, Ashwatthama, okay. Sorry.
Yeah, is dead, you know, so that really everything...
Yeah.
The highest truth is following whatever Krishna's
right
direction is given. And I know they say, you know, in other venues, they would say that Yudhisthira, he walked above, he never touched the earth. But when he took up that lie, he touched the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But our understanding is that because he hesitated to tell the lie, even though
exactly
Krishna directed him, that's why he...
Yeah. And, you know, and that was such a wonderful example of how, you know, the highest truth is whatever Krishna wants, whatever is Krishna's desire. And so because Krishna want him to do that, it was actually to save people in the battlefield, right? Who was Ashwatthama's father? Dronacharya? Yeah. Yeah. So in other words, so Dronacharya was, I guess, was defeating, you know, some of them really badly. So when he said that, he thought his son was dead, and he, you know, that kind of like stopped him in the battle. And actually, of course, it was the elephant. But yeah, that's an interesting story. And that actually shows how these religious principles are even somewhat relative. You know, what's absolute is Krishna and Krishna's will and Krishna's desire, and how those fit are relative to what Krishna wants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think for the most part, we say, you know, Krishna wants us to follow his regular principles, but if for some reason, like with Yudhisthira, he didn't, that's what we do.
Yeah.
Okay, I think I need to hand plug this. One more.
Thank you for a wonderful class, Prabhu. It's a quick question. Is there a difference between feeling satisfaction in like doing a service and pride? I mean, sometimes...
Yeah.
It's a, just like you say something like cooking, you know, happy to have it on time and put salt and put everything in, the satisfaction.
Yeah, because we're not impersonal, or we're like, you know, I don't care. I just did it. It's my service. Did the service. Done. You know, I have no attachment to it. It's not quite like that. We want to do well. We want to cook nicely for Krishna. So I think the satisfaction that you feel is reciprocation from Krishna. Right? In other words, you're serving Krishna, you're serving really nicely, and Krishna is pleased. You know, which probably contributes to your feeling of satisfaction because Krishna was pleased. So I think that's more a matter of reciprocation. You know. I mean, one could just feel proud and puffed up. Oh, I did a great job. Yeah, sure, that could be there. But I think if a devotee is very sincere, it's more... Yeah. Okay. I've got an appointment I've got to take off. Yeah, I'll go to the Prabhupada.